Whoever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you are catching some rain waves coming to you from the banks of the nimble and fleeting St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Becky Peters, and across the table from me is Mr. Ben Kalb, whose one regret in life is having no understanding of what regret feels like.
Well, you can hardly blame me. How can I have regrets when I have the insane privilege of co-hosting Vrain Waves, the podcast aimed at making us more informed, inspired, and connected educators? We have certainly been out kicking our coverage with guests who we have no business even talking to and really even emailing. And no one demonstrates that more than our guest in the last episode, where we talk with the founding father of 20 Time, the godfather of Genius Hour, AJ Giuliani. And he gives you some advice that you can't refuse. So as soon as you finish this episode, you got to go back and give it a listen. And we continue the tradition of being in way over our heads with our next guests as we talk to formative assessment experts Dr. Carrie Holmberg and Brent Ducour.
No doubt about any of that, Ben. In this episode with Carrie and Brent, we discuss their newest book called Mastering Formative Assessment Moves. But before we launch into our interview with them, we're going to discuss some of our favorite practical tips and suggestions around formative assessment. But if you want to get right into their interview, feel free to skip ahead to minute 7:55.
We are 14 episodes in, so I feel like it's finally time to let my guard down. I can be a little bit vulnerable with you and the audience here, Becky.
I'm ready.
During my first year teaching, I used to love formatively assessing my students, and I put formative assessment in quotes as I'm saying that. You can't see it, but I am, because I truly thought that a formative assessment was just a fancy way of saying a pretest. So I'd do something like this. I would schedule my end of the unit multiple choice test on like a Thursday for something like the executive branch, and then on Friday to start my next unit, say like the legislative branch, I'd give another multiple choice test on the legislative branch as like a pretest, and it was just the version C or B of the test that came with my textbook. So they were the most awesome days because my kids were quiet in rows taking a test, and I could just sit at my desk and catch up on parent emails. And my friend Scantron machine would do all of the work for me. So that's being vulnerable. Thankfully, my understanding of formative assessment has really grown over the past couple years. And the discussion that we get into with Dr. Holmberg and Dr. Ducour in a second really take my understanding of formative assessment to a whole new level.
Yeah, me too, Ben. My understanding of formative assessment was really turned on its head through reading their book and through our discussion. A few of the things that really perplexed me were how formative assessment really blurs the lines between what we call testing and instruction, that we don't just assess to see what students know in like a thumbs up or a thumbs down way, but that students can and should be learning through assessment. So how awesome is that? To learn anything, we have to connect our new learning to prior knowledge, and we can do that through different formative assessment moves. The other really cool thing about their book is that when you do formative assessment really well, it's not Ben checking his email while his kids do yet another multiple choice Scantron.
Wow. Shots fired there, Becky. Shots
I'm just teasing fired. You, man. It's I cannot throw stones from this glass house. We've all been there. But when formative assessment's done well, it's really an intricate dance of these seven moves that all play off one another and happen simultaneously. So it's not like a step-by-step thing. But as always, we want a good deal of this podcast to be focused on the how. So that's why we're asking.
Hey, Siri, what time is it?
It's time to get out of our heads and into the classroom.
I need help! Somebody, please help me.
Help me!
Give me something I can use. Let's get out of our heads and into the classroom.
That's right. It's out of our heads and into the classroom, the part of the show where we give tangible tips and actionable advice that you can put into practice right away. And for this episode, we're going to focus on formative assessment.
So there are so many cool formative assessment strategies, and as a technology coordinator, I got to say how I would do these things using some instructional technology. One of the ones I really like is doing something like two truths and a lie, where after you've learned a concept, that you have students create two things that are true about it and something that is untrue about it. And there are tons of ways that you can house this two truths and a lie. I like the idea of doing a shared Google slideshow where every student adds a slide where they put their two truths and a lie. If you're using Schoology, they could do it as a discussion prompt. But I think that's an interesting, cool way of having students really demonstrate their learning, and you can pick up on what they understand and what they don't through their two truths and a lie. The other one that I really like that I've gotten into recently because it also gets students engaged is the idea of having students create a meme around a concept that you've learned. And again, there are tons of places that you can house these memes. Afterwards, you could do it on a shared Google slide. They could do it as a media gallery inside of Schoology. But having, you know, after you learn a concept, have students create a clever meme for it. And we will link to a couple meme creators on the show notes. And where we would house these as well. How about you, Becky?
Good. Those are good ones, Ben. Thank you for that. Well, first I want to say we can't really ignore the power of active retrieval for formative assessment, where students try to recall as much as they can about the concept that they just learned. We'll get more into that in a future episode. But for today, for formative assessment, I want to highlight asking students to create analogies. When you let students expand on a relationship and elaborate on their understanding of that relationship, the learning will stick that much more. I think I'm so attracted to these specifically because it's so hard for me to come up with them. I'm really not that good at it. But when I hear one that resonates with me, it really digs its way into my long-term memory. So they can obviously go much deeper than like, you know, green is to grass as blue is to sky. Think more like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. What did that do for civil rights versus what is the defining moment in activism for gay rights or for women's rights? And then let students engage in that discussion, defending their creative decisions on what they come up with. That can be pretty enlightening for you as a teacher and also for them as a learner as to where they're at with their understanding of that concept. Or to be super meta about this, I'm going to give you another analogy. Dr. John Hattie writes the foreword for this book that we're going to talk about with Carrie and Brent in a minute, and he quotes a guy named Bob Steak, who likens formative assessment to a chef tasting soup while she's making it, that you can then adjust your next moves based on that information, and then when the guest tastes that soup, that's the summative assessment. Both are useful in different ways, but the soup analogy is really something that we can all relate to, and that helps us frame formative assessment in a more concrete way.
Tangible advice is really just the tip of the iceberg. Our guests Brent and Carrie do an awesome job of sharing both high level and nuts and bolts with their formative assessment moves.
And it's a really unique interview because this is our first time having co-authors on. It was a super fun experience we hope to have again. Dr. Brent Ducour is an associate professor in the teacher education program at San Jose State. Before that, he taught at Central Park East Secondary School in New York City. And Dr. Carrie Holmberg is a lecturer and pre-service teacher educator at San Jose State. And before that, she was a National Board Certified Teacher and a consultant for the Bay Area Writing Project.
And in this episode, we talk about why you should formatively assess. We talk about why you shouldn't read every piece of writing that your students turn in. And we go more in depth into their 7 moves of formative assessment. Now, these moves, like we heard earlier from Becky, are a dance and they happen interchangeably. And I'm going to quickly tell you what those are so that you have a little background knowledge before Brent and Carrie bring them up in their interview. So the 7 moves. Priming is helping your students be prepared for learning publicly. Posing, which is asking questions. Pausing, which is giving proper wait time. Probing, which is asking follow-up questions using some of the student's initial responses in the question. You have bouncing, which is how you take in student information and sample from it. Tagging, which is publicly representing student thinking. And then binning, which is putting student learning into different categories. So TikTok, let's make it rock. I was just thinking, as I was reading your 332-page amazing book on formative assessment, truly, like it's my go-to resource on formative assessment now, and I love it. But as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think of a man who I taught with my first year teaching, who was at the end of his career. He was a U.S. teacher, and I remember we had an in-service on formative assessment, and he was like, ugh, formative assessment? I mean, if these kids knew about selective incorporation, they'd be teaching the class. Why do I need to ask them? Like, I know they don't know it. And so he would justify not giving a formative assessment just by saying, hey, I know the kids don't know my content, so why would I waste time giving a formative assessment? How would you respond to him? And we'll just call him Kevin Colby, because that was his name, and he's a friend, so I'm sure he's okay with it.
Well, I wouldn't want to shout out Kevin for the teacher that I once was, and probably we all have been and will continue to be. We all know that there's a tremendous demand on pacing and moving through our material and making sure we cover every single thing. So there is that sense of the demands of getting through the material make you want to suspect that the students don't really know much and that's why they're there. Well, I've come to since realize, and maybe Kevin will come on this journey with us, in the cognitive revolution, or what we now call sort of neo-constructivism, but there's a deep psychology and a lot of research around how people learn. The National Research Council wrote a book in 1999, just a couple of years before it put out the work on knowing what students know. And in that book, it stated very clearly, this is like we're looking at 20 years ago, kids actually do need to build on prior knowledge and associations, not just of facts, but sometimes of misperceptions or even just random ideas that they may have picked up from TV. They may have picked up from hearing a conversation at the dinner table, that they may have gotten from a previous class years ago. And for some reason, it's stuck in their memory. Some fact about, for example, the World War II. Or about war in general. You know, most kids come to our classrooms with a lot of prior cultural knowledge and experience around war. It's in the movies, it's in the video games, it's sort of distributed, we could say, in the wild. So every teacher wants to make use of that material as a check for where the kids are on a concept as complicated as war, revolution, and kids are better served when we build the bridges from where their own understanding is to the content than when we sort of ignore it and pretend that they're a blank slate. You know, part of the sensibility of this book and of, I would say, really the education research for the last 20 years has been around what we call, again, constructivism. Some people call it sociocultural learning. But at the end of the day, these are big words to just say, hey, figure out what the kids know in part by unpacking their experience. If it worked for John Dewey, I think it'll work for us too.
So you say that in the book, doing formative assessment is a lot harder than handing out a quiz, collecting homework, or administering a unit test. Posing questions is messy, probing for responses is time-consuming, and pausing for think time can be awkward. So why do it?
Why formatively assess? Formative assessment as a process of listening to students in the classroom, as you say, asking them questions, probing, is one of the most evidence-based teacher strategies that we know of that advances student learning.
I would throw in that why we do it is because ultimately we are trying to figure out whether the students have even begun to understand what it is we thought we just taught. That is the real story of formative assessment. It closes the gap almost immediately between what we think we're teaching and what we think the students are potentially understanding, including what they're misunderstanding. You know, when we talk about misconceptions or PPRIMs or just the prior knowledge that students bring to the table in a classroom, we want to know almost immediately what that is. And one of the problems with quizzes and tests and homework is there's kind of a time lag or a delay between what we've just taught and what we think we now know that the student has either obtained or achieved or come to understand.
I remember being in teacher college, and I guess calling it that makes it sound like clown college. But I think I was taught that a formative assessment is just a check for understanding. And after reading your book and being in the classroom for a lot of years, I think my idea of what formative assessment has morphed. But why is formative assessment more than just a check for understanding, thumbs up, thumbs down kind of thing?
Ultimately, we want to know something about whether students have acquired an understanding of why things sink and float, or whether segregation, the civil rights movement, is something that goes beyond the Brown versus Board education decision, or whether we want to get deeper into the question of what makes a piece of artwork cubist, or whether graffiti itself can be thought of as a new form of impressionism. The bottom line is that the big essential questions that drive instruction and good instruction really always ask not only the question, what are we assessing, but what do we really want kids to know and be able to do? And so I think formative assessment, by the way, whether it's a checklist or whether it is a tool or whether it's conceived of as a set of moves, as we talk about it, has to always be tied to the content that we're learning. And I would frame that even larger as the essential questions that drive the curriculum.
So we're going to go a little bit more with the high level, and then we'll start getting down into those seven moves. I wanted to ask a little bit about, you present the moves as a honeycomb, as a wheel, and you suggest that they're not steps, but they're active and used in combination, which, as you mentioned, is more like a dance really than a recipe or steps. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that's important for your work?
It's important to our work because we really focus on that formatively assessing in the classroom really depends on teacher decision making. It would be unprofessional to be telling teachers exactly what decisions to make when, because we can't anticipate all the changing conditions that are happening in the classroom. So that the moves could happen in any direction according to what teachers are taking in, what they're seeing about their students before them, is really important. It's also backed by sound principles of educational assessment. Undergirding our work is a group of experts that gathered to determine what are these sound principles of educational assessment. We'd like to think that we're teaching on the shoulders of giants, as Rain Waves calls it. And what they determined as they gathered in 2001 in the National Research Council is that to assess, whether it's on the fly or even summatively, you have to have a model of how students are progressing in what you're trying to assess. You have to have a set of observations, and then you have to interpret these observations. And so the moves are a flexible way to use these three elements of how students develop progress in what you're trying to assess, how you get the observations by posing questions, pausing to give students think time, probing, and then interpreting using the information that you get back from the students and doing this in a flexible way.
Good answer. And one thing that I was reflecting on during your last response too is that one thing you guys write in the book and you said in your webinar, any teacher can be amazing at these things. It's not just for veteran teachers. It's very applicable for novice teachers. And in some ways, you know, if you start your classroom journey off this way, you might even get better at it faster, which I love. So let's dig into a few of the moves for all of our teachers out there that are listening. So I think it'd be appropriate to start with priming since that's kind of the foundation for the rest of them. And you mentioned in the book, priming can help make not only learning visible, but it can go a long way in making students visible. I'd like you guys to talk a little bit about what priming is and how you see it being used in the classroom in a valuable way.
Students being seen in the classroom is so critical to their learning. We need to see them in order to meet them where they are. So priming is about teachers and students both are continuously asking questions of each other, not just asking, but then, you know, probing, writing ideas down so they can refer to them again and again, which we, that's our tagging move, which we call tagging. That can feel entirely uncomfortable to students. It's a new way for many of our students of doing school. And so priming moves prepare and reassure learners that yes, this feels uncomfortable. It can feel very new and it's worth doing. We can get through this together.
Practically speaking, what are some cool ways you've seen teachers do priming? If we have a segment in our show called Out of Our Heads Into the Classroom, where we really practically look at some of what some of these strategies would look like in real life. So how have you seen priming used in a technical way or just non-tech?
You know, one of the most easy examples that we often show in our professional development workshops, and we obviously have shown our pre-service teachers as well, is what we call the warm-up of the warm-up. So for example, if you're teaching a unit of mathematics and you're going to start to review the concept of ratio, and you know that kids have had some experience with it, perhaps a couple weeks before, perhaps a year or two ago, but you know that also they're not quite yet ready for the formal definition. It's not time just to simply write down what's the definition of ratio and then to apply that to a particular algorithm and problem. We start with the idea of what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word ratio. Now, if you're about to prime that, you've got to start with this idea of reinforcing and setting the norms around the classroom with posters, with sentences. We all have the right to be wrong. We all can risk an explanation. Our voices should be heard. You need to let the kids know that taking that risk to answer that open-ended question, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word ratio, is not only permissible, but it's expected. We often have our teachers learn the sentence starter, and we work with ourselves the same sentence starter when we do our own work. There are no right or wrong answers here. I'm interested in your ideas, your beliefs, your thoughts. You can write it down. You can say it. You can say it to a friend and let the friend say it to the whole class. Priming reminds everybody that socio-emotional learning is hardly a new concept. We really focused on the habits of heart in addition to the habits of mind. And habits of heart mean letting kids know through posters, through verbal cues and reminders, through modeling, that we actually value not just the participation, but also the ideas and beliefs of our students.
Your chapter on priming for me helped me shift my idea of a formative assessment. Your book talks about how formative assessments blend the line between instruction and assessment, that priming is a way for the teacher to figure out what kids know and how they can shift their instruction for it, but it also helps the kid learn by giving them some information to tie the new learning to. So that was really what helped it solidify in my mind that they formative assessments blur the lines between instruction and assessment. And I love that example.
Well, yeah, because Ben, if as teachers, if students learn just what we taught, we wouldn't have to assess. We could just list out our lesson plans and be done. But that's not what we do in the classroom. As you know, what happens in the classroom depends on relationships between teachers and students and how well teachers can listen. Sometimes I've heard that, you know, authors write the book that they most need to hear. I, as a teacher, needed to really work at getting to be a better listener. I had so many ideas in my head, but that didn't mean I was present and could take in what they were actually saying in the moment, what they were saying by their body language, what they were saying with their words, through their performances, and their writing. What I think is useful about the moves is that having language and concepts to use to help me get better for what I do as a professional in the moment is really useful, because a book that helps me get better outside of class when I'm not paid to do my work. Yes, I need to take that in and use that to develop myself as a professional. But I, again, ideas and concepts that I can use to get better at time I'm already spending in the classroom is really, really important to me.
There are two awesome things you just said there. The first is that having the common language around the moves to help you get better at it. We talked with Elizabeth Green about like the lack of just a common lexicon for the things that we do every day. And I think your book really helps us do that with formative assessment, which is awesome. And then the thing about listening to your students, I mean, I think that's where we all start off. And I know we've all got horror stories about how, I mean, I used to race through the material and I had so many ideas about things I wanted to get through that I never really took the time to listen to what they were coming in with and pay attention to what they were saying to me in class. And I think we can use that as a springboard to talk about another one of your moves, which is pausing, which I feel is kind of like the holy grail for most classrooms. It, you know, like we've talked about the rush to get through and the awkward pauses and things like this. So why is it important to revisit the importance of this formative assessment move and what can we learn about that for our classrooms?
Well, pausing is absolutely essential to processing time for students and for teachers. And a large body of evidence going back to Mary Budd Rowe in the early 70s, she conducted lots of studies across the country with a variety of students from kindergarten to university. And she didn't start with looking at wait time, which is part of pausing. Brent and I, the definition of pausing doesn't necessarily imply silent pausing, which Mary Budd Rowe's research on wait time does presume that it's silent, but she didn't start there. Her research started with just how can we work with teachers to get classrooms to be places of more inquiry. She was interested in inquiry processes. And so from looking at classrooms that were doing inquiry well, they bumped into that there really was very little pausing going on. I mean, when I say very little, I'm talking on the order of like 3 conversations out of 200 that were recorded had noticeable pauses. And by noticeable, I mean like 3 seconds. And so what they also came to was that, so something hinges on this pausing. Teachers need it to hear what students are saying. Students need it to continue their own speech. This was another big finding of her study, is that students speak in bursts, and then between the bursts of their speech, they would pause for 3 to 5 seconds. But inevitably, the teacher had jumped in during that time. So basically interrupting the student. So the teacher had never learned whether the student was going to continue or not. And so this culture was inadvertently created in classrooms where students weren't listening to one another because they knew the teacher was going to jump in. And with the beginning teachers that Brent and I work with at San Jose State, we see this happening all the time. And I think particularly it comes from beginning teachers wanting to build up their teaching identity. You know, they're the ones with authority and running the classroom. So there's perhaps some good reasons why this is happening. But Mary Budd Rowe and Kenneth Tobin and others through this research, they found that if pauses of between 3 to 5 seconds could happen between what students contributed to a small group or a whole class conversation in class, some really magical things could start to happen. One of those important things is that teachers got better at the follow-up questions they next asked.
Mm. Because that wait time gives the teacher an opportunity to actually process themselves, to size up what the next best question is, given what they've just heard. And I think to get really practical, because we've grown so far in this profession since those early studies, the idea of a turn and talk is the most basic go-to pausing move any teacher needs to know on Monday morning. If you don't have time for a turn and talk, then you don't have time for cognitive processing and for kids to actually get comfortable and get focused and start thinking with you. So I think of it as some of these things are just sort of bottom line go-tos that we all can do. I want to zoom back out though and build off what Carrie said, because you know when we talk about pausing as a move, it's really interesting. When Black and Willem published their seminal article in 1998 on sort of what's inside the black box and really focused on the first meta-analytic studies of the impact of formative assessment on student achievement, the beauty of something like pausing and how it feeds so many different practices from classroom management, multiculturalism in terms of hearing all voices, certainly an idea about language and literacy. We teach in very heterogeneous classrooms. We have a strong commitment to equity around language learning and the development of academic language in the classroom. You know, you just think about the multiplying effect of something like pausing, as it builds not only on supporting teachers' work across these different areas, but also in their own internal growth. Pausing is a continuum. It's not simply a one-off, and you can get better at it with different strategies based on the kids, the context, and the changing curriculum. And we outline that. We talk about that. We invite us to think about it as a lifelong practice.
I had a teacher in high school who I said in another podcast was able to teach a whole class just by asking amazing questions. And he always had the perfect follow-up. And as a teacher, I never had that perfect follow-up question. I wondered how he did it. And your book talks about, yeah, if you give students time and you pause and you, that's going to give you that better follow-up question. And so I loved that idea too, that not only does it help the students think deeper, but it also is going to help you with that next question.
You know, Ben, isn't that that tension between we all want our work to be faster, more efficient, and go easy. So if someone could just hand us those great questions, then we could just move along. But the other side of it is we want to own and be authentic around what's happening inside of our own classrooms with the kids we teach. One of the things we talk about are the habits of mind as organizing principles and deep questions. So I would hope that somebody could start with a question based on the learning target of evidence, to kids understand evidence, something like, well, how do we know that? And then that teacher you're mentioning, you know, he must have listened or she must have listened for years to the kinds of responses kids typically were giving, and then was able from there to build good probing questions and follow-ups. So you need somewhere to start, but you also want to be open to building your own repertoire.
And helping teachers, there's a move that's really helpful to teachers in building their own repertoire. And that's tagging. Tagging is the move of visually representing students' responses where all can have access to it. So it usually involves writing, but it can be drawing for the purpose of honoring it, making sense of it, and the capacity to refer to it again and again. Teachers build their pedagogical content knowledge over time, right? They build this idea of what students typically say in response to certain questions, where students typically struggle with certain concepts, right? Like a lot of students adding fractions for the first time, right? They're just going to add straight across the numerators and the denominators and right, and make a common misconception that way. It takes time for teachers to build that knowledge up. And by having students' ideas represented in the classroom through tagging, they can do this in a way quicker. And there are benefits to this. Not only do teachers build up their knowledge by having it represented, is that students, it's another way that they feel seen. And when students are doing the tagging or scribing, is the way we call it, if students are the ones recording the ideas for all to see, their sense of belonging and identity in the classroom is enhanced. And that's really important.
We walk into schools, we see people tagging all the time. We see people tagging with now the new technologies. I don't want to shout out any particular company, but we've all been in a Google Classroom. We've all seen now that you can do real-time tagging, and the teachers are really quite good at all this. They just don't call it tagging necessarily, not yet. But we like to remind everybody that high-tech tagging is wonderful. Sure, for sighted students and non-sighted students, there's lots of ways we could think about making student thinking visible. But there's also low-tech solutions, like literally just walking up to the old-fashioned dry erase board and using a dry erase marker, hopefully not another type, and having the students go up on the board and that question, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of or hear the word ratio? We've seen teachers in 2 to 3 minutes have students or themselves tag out all the possibilities of what that means. And then the teacher will thread all the student ideas and link that to actually the next segue, which is a formal definition of ratio. The idea of tagging is exactly what Carrie said. It's making visible and representing and honoring student work, but it's also allowing the teacher to then pivot to where they want to go next in the lesson, which might be a more formal direct instruction strategy. So the idea of weaving these moves through your lesson over 55 minutes, 75 minutes, whether you're on the blacktop, whether you're in a science lab, whether you're sitting in a standard, you know, English language arts classroom, you're using these moves to help move you and the students along into multiple modalities of teaching.
With your example there with the ratio on the board, just kind of playing the devil's advocate here. As a teacher, you know, when that's done really well and the teacher's able to weave this awesome narrative and tie everything that was on the board together, when you see that, you're like, oh, that's amazing. But that's also really hard to do. And a kid could write something completely random on the board, and a lot of control is gone too. So how would you encourage a teacher to try that?
Well, Ben, that's the example we use every Tuesday night in the second week of our class at San Jose State. What happens when the F-bomb comes flying over cross and volleys into the table? You know, what happens when the I don't know. What happens when crickets go on? I'm not so worried about the control around whether kids are saying things. Sometimes I've just got dead silence. Yeah. And so how do you manage the anxiety? Carrie, what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, the anxiety from hearing crickets when you pose a question and responses aren't coming back when you were expecting a flood of them, because boy, you did such a good job planning your question in this lesson. In short, it's terrifying. And I think it's the responsibility of more experienced teachers to be the, what did you call it, Ben, the marigolds, to be the companion plants for their fellow colleagues and help them through this phase in teaching. Because I think it is a phase. I think that teachers can get over the anxiety of hearing silence in the classroom, and that they will, and that their colleagues can encourage them in that.
If I could play angel's advocate to Ben's devil's advocate, one of the really funny things about this is, well, what if you don't tag? What if instead, or you don't pause, what if you simply give a quiz and you collect up on Friday all the I don't knows and the F-bombs on a private little piece of paper in which you feel in control and can now discipline or complain about how little your students learn? Really, in the end, you're still getting the same response. You're just getting it later. And so I think another way of thinking about this is, yes, it's about control, and yes, it's about facilitation, and yes, it's also sometimes simply about failing, falling on your, you know, just on your face. But isn't that the entire thing we love about teaching? It's like a tightrope walk. Yes, there are days in which we have just sailed through and nailed it. And then there are the days in which we're like, hey, I tried that last week and it just bombed this week. So part of us goes back to each of these moves, like every other piece of advice you're ever going to hear or get on teaching and learning, is subject to revision, is subject to reconsideration, and we would even say is subject to trying again. Because nothing typically works perfectly every time, every day. That's why I think so many people outside of education miss the point of what we do. We are not fitting into tiny product boxes. We are not easily served by one size fits all solutions. Teachers, like artists, are often dealing with the complexity of the moment, and we've got to get more comfortable with that.
I have one more practical question with respect to tagging, because I've seen a bunch of classrooms with amazing student work all over the walls, but I've also gone into classrooms in like August or September, beginning of the year, when the walls are already plastered with anchor charts and things that students never really refer to because they didn't have a whole lot of input to them to begin with. And I wonder how that looks in a classroom where students are creating those sorts of things that are up around the room that they can refer back to, you know, with tagging.
Well, in our priming chapter, we exactly invite people in the last segment to do that, to build those agreements with their own teachers to figure out what it is they value. And then on the tagging side of things, it goes back to, does it have to be as formal as putting up student work on posters around a wall, or is it more ephemeral, which is like, today we just worked on a Word document and we just all tagged our responses and commentaries on how to improve that persuasive essay. And, you know, that is in some sense not going to be sitting around the walls, but somewhere on a hard drive or perhaps in the next version or draft. You know, I think the essence of what you're really saying is, what do we do with tagging after we've tagged it? Like, you know, and does it just become kind of dead weight? And I think that goes back to uses. At the end of the day, it only matters how the data is used, how it informs and improves the lives of people around it. So I would say the tagging data can be thought of as archival, but it also really needs to be thought of as kind of a, what we might say, a scaffold or a support for students to remember what it is we're doing right now and to be able to add and contribute to that process. I just want to say another thing about tagging. We didn't mention bouncing.
Yeah.
And bouncing is actually the precursor to good tagging. Carrie, you want to say a little bit more about bouncing and sampling and how that idea is before we even get to the soft data? We've got to have a way of getting to everybody.
Yeah, we have to, well, we have to have a way of taking in what students know. We talked before about the assessment triangle, right? Model of how students develop competence in your learning target, what you're hoping that they're learning. Then we talked about observations and interpretation. To make an accurate interpretation about where your learners are, and teachers are responsible for a classroom of learners, anywhere from 17 to 42 children or adolescents in a classroom, we need to have a way to systematically sample, and that's bouncing. So bouncing is a fun word to think about the concept of how am I gathering information about where my students are with what I am hoping that they're learning. Am I doing it haphazardly? Am I just having a conversation between me and the three students who keep raising their hands? That's the case, and I've got to really change things up and sample and bounce in a different way so that I hear from more of my students.
Formative assessment doesn't wait again until the end of the unit or the end of the year. Formative assessment is about essentially each day trying to figure out where everyone is. So rather than put a big burden on teachers like, hey, you should give tests every day to know how kids are doing, and that'd just be wrong, we start with a more simple idea, which is just bounce around. And bounce systematically in terms of, well, where are my quiet learners? Where are the folks who may be more introverted in their approach to my class? So how do I give them voice? And maybe I bounce not by pouncing on them with a question, but coming to the side with something more like a pause, wait time, or pair share, which allows that student to engage the material and then find a way to give back to the whole class. So again, this idea that bouncing is not alone, pausing is not alone, priming is not alone, posing is not alone. These are moves that you need to figure out how to sort of synchronize and integrate, and actually can be shown quite quickly to do, because in many of your schools, you already have the teachers doing this. You're just now getting from us that common grammar, that language to talk about what you're doing, to share ideas on what works and what doesn't.
So would bouncing be, I mean, just thinking of teachers with the tin cup with the popsicle sticks who pull them out, is that like a form of it?
Yeah, that's an example of bouncing that's popular and useful, right? Yeah. Because it does, randomize. And some teachers, as we know, when they pull out the popsicle sticks from the can, it's not entirely random, but looks random, right? And that's one of those just teaching secrets that we are entirely allowed to have as professionals. It's sound practice to be
that's
random.
That was an inside the classroom right there. Totally. Pull out. It says Bob on the stick, but you call on Becky. I did it all the time.
That's right.
It's a pro tip right there. Write it down.
That's a pro tip.
How about, you know, you get a bunch of written student work in and you just randomly, you're looking for certain things, like rather than reviewing the whole thing and doing comments on all that, is that a kind of a form of bouncing too then?
Yes. So targeted bouncing, what you're looking for. So when it comes to student writing, any kind of student writing, right? One rule of thumb is if you're reading everything students write, your students aren't writing enough. So for survival in this field, you have to bounce purposefully, right? So the aspect of looking at how am I being systematic, right? Am I getting in the class, if I'm listening in on groups, am I listening in to my quieter learners? Am I listening into my learners that I know tend to struggle with this? Am I listening into my excited ones? Just in that same vein, as you're looking at written student work, always, always, always have to be purposeful and strategic and targeted about what you're looking for.
Percent rule, by the way. Can I just say that 20%?
Oh, please do,
rule?
Yeah.
If I just did one out of five papers, I'm ahead of the game for my sampling each day. It's kind of like with my exit slips. If I do 37 exit slips multiplied times five, I'm working way too hard. I might collect those exit slips, but I've got to be able to quickly, what we call bin, that's our last move, quickly sort of say, maybe it's three bins, you know, still not engaged, ready to play and got some ideas, and then someone who sort of got it. And then I can say, well, quickly move away the first two categories, the first one and three, focus in on the people who are kind of in the middle. And what do I learn from that enough to say, tomorrow I'm going to go in and focus on this for my lesson. I'm going to either reteach or I'm going to revisit. The idea is you got to be somewhat flexible here. It's not like we're saying, you know, sit down and do more homework checking. We're talking about, like you said, bouncing strategically. Sorry, Ben.
No, and I just can't tell you how much freedom that gives me, and guilt that like lets loose. We actually had an author on from New Hampshire who said he just feels so guilty for all the grading he hasn't gotten to. And you're so right. If I just want to isolate that clip of that Carrie said of, if you're reading every word your kids write, they're not writing nearly enough. And that is so true. Not as an excuse to not be working hard, obviously, but you're right. We want them writing a lot more. And thank you for just the confessional there.
So it sounds to me like each one of of these, they work together so well, and you don't do any of them in isolation, right? So say I'm new, how do you suggest to teachers to learn these moves? Do you isolate one at a time and try to get really good at it? Or is it best to try to digest them all and then like see how they interplay to master them better? You know, how do you approach this with people that are new?
I recommend triplets, and starting with a triplet of posing, pausing, and probing, knowing that for a lot of people starting out, that the pausing is going to feel uncomfortable, and that the questions that they might first use for probing will be weird, too long, have too much academic language for the learners. I recommend teachers start with posing, pausing, and probing, and see what that gets them in terms of surprising things that they hear back from students in the moment. Because for me, when teachers get excited about the surprising things that they hear from students, they're on the path to really staying with how to improve. Because if something is fascinating to you, you're not going to let it go, and you're going to work to solve whatever that question is. I don't know, maybe that's my own bias, because that's the kind of learner and person that I am. But also, having worked with a lot of teachers who've been in the profession for a long time, when I hear them talk about what surprises them, their students have said, they're committed to getting better.
Rebecca, you know, you taught STEM, as I understand it, and have worked in that field. And one of the examples we give was some of the work that our own mentors did with why things sink and float, and looking at curriculum that really try to uncover ideas around buoyancy, density, relative density, all pretty big ideas, you know. But the fact that students have these so-called misconceptions, they're actually fascinating. I mean, things as simple as, you know, objects with sharp objects will sink. These are just kind of cool, like, yeah, you know, let's get into this, guys. Let's think about this a bit. You know, you may remember one of the actual assessment strategies developed out of some of the work that my mentors at Berkeley and Stanford did was the predict, observe, explain routine, right? Where the students are asked to predict something, then they observe it, and then they go ahead and they try to explain what they observe. We actually included that for teachers in our own moves-based framework. We asked the same question. Why don't you predict what you think the students will say to the question you plan to pose? Then why don't you observe in the 55-minute lesson and take some notes at the end over lunch break? What did they actually say? You might even video record if you want to do that. It's a little bit over the top, but just take some quick notes. And then ask yourself, well, you know, why did it go differently than I thought it was? Or what could I have done differently? You know, we're also now borrowing from some of the really rich pedagogy coming out of the science and STEM curriculum, and bringing that back into our own moves framework. We see this as very much a borrowing and sharing enterprise, either looking from elementary up through secondary, or looking across disciplines. What are the best practices, whether they're coming out of Hattie's work, whether they're coming out of the work that Dr. Lori Shepherd has done at the University of Colorado on assessment and STEM, whether they're just good old work coming from Jim Popham. You know, we like to just work with anybody we can to make this easier for all of us who are on the journey to becoming formative assessors.
Yeah. And I want to include in that list, Robert Linquanti out of WestEd for his definition of formative assessment, focus on English language learners and how formative assessment as a process of teachers and students speaking and listening to one another in the classroom really supports students in developing their second or third language. For all students, it supports them in developing academic language, right? Maybe they're a native speaker of language, but they don't speak the language of science yet, the language of mathematics. But both those populations, students needing to learn academic language, which is all students, right? And especially students for whom English is an additional language and they're still learning. Formative assessment as a process and the moves really support their language development. For me, it's a matter of, yeah, equity and social justice and supporting students in a way that we need to support them while they're with us in public school.
I love how your use of the word borrowing, and you obviously built this book on the shoulders of giants. And John Hattie, who wrote the Four Deer book and just killed it, did a great job with that. He speaks a lot of assessment capable learners. And so we obviously could keep this conversation going. Like, this has been one of the fastest hours ever. We've loved it. But I would love to kind of end our discussion with, how do you see the student's role in formative assessment?
John knows what we've known for a long time in some of the most progressive and interesting, certainly elementary and secondary school reforms in the U.S., which is that the student cannot just see us as engaging them in content delivery and content acquisition, then we're like robots to them. You know, we're ultimately just people who are being put in front of a screen, they're in the audience, and they're supposed to just take notes. For them to get more of an active stance towards their own learning and begin to internalize the lessons that we think they should learn more about, they're going to need not just to say, oh, that's a really cool graphic, or I love that video we saw today, or wasn't it fun to go out and do that project? That's the instructional side. They're going to have to also feel like, hey, I'm going to self-assess and figure out where I need to go. Or I'm going to work with my peers on a gallery walk, and I'm going to find my buddy, and we're going to go and make notes and say what we think could be improved in this art gallery project. The bottom line is, whether we're doing self-assessment, peer assessment, or even just telling the teacher through some sort of formal process, and it can be note-taking, it doesn't have to be essays, here's where I think I am, or here's where I need to go next. That assessment capability is at the heart of joining the teacher's wishes with the student's wishes and desires. We all like to know, in some sense, that we're not just being evaluated from the outside in, but also that we ourselves as insiders can have a voice in how we're being evaluated.
So on that note then too, how transparent are you with students with this language, with the language of the formative assessment moves and with formative assessment in general, in order to help them become more capable, assessment capable learners?
You know, I've had the experience of working in a high school and in a school network for the Coalition of Essential Schools, where we were very transparent and visible about our learning goals. In fact, at Central Park East Secondary School, we actually posted in every classroom the habits of mind that all students were accountable for, including the teachers. Those habits of mind were connections, perspective, evidence, conjecture, and relevance. And we phrased those learning targets as questions, of essential questions. So how do we know what we know? How is this similar to another like idea or different idea? The point being that in every classroom, it was visible to students. Now, I've often played with in my own mind, what would it be like for a school to have its own essential school-wide learning goals, which many do? And then would you put underneath that, you know, we pose with excitement, we pause with respect, we probe with care, you know, we
curiosity.
We bounce for joy, we tag for accuracy. You know, we pose for a commitment to learning. The idea that we do these things together every day, minute by minute, not just because the teacher wants to make moves, but because they actually help us to achieve our goals as a collective, which is the classroom.
You guys were so generous with your time. I really can't say enough positive things about your book. It's definitely going to be in my huge recommended list, and we're going to put tons of links to it in the show notes. But our last question, we'll let you run on this, is where can our listeners go to learn from and with you?
We would love for all of our listeners to just check in with us via email or via our website. Our website is validitypartners.com. And we have there a way to contact us by email. There are some resources on that website that are for free. There are also some ways in which we can get you material if you just go ahead and let us know that you're interested. But just let us know. We're eager to help. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Another brain-blowing interview for sure. Let's close up shop, Ben. What'd you learn?
It wasn't until I read this book and had the conversation with them that I really internalized how assessment is actually part of learning. It's not something you do afterwards all the time, but it really is the way of building the bridge from what you knew before to what you know now. And as Brent said, it's super crucial. So I was really informed and inspired by that thinking. How about you, Becky?
Carrie had a lot of mic drop moments in this, and I enjoyed her challenge to experienced teachers to build up young teachers and let them know that it's hard, but it gets better. And I really liked her guilt-relieving statement of, if you read everything your students are writing, they aren't writing nearly enough.
Yeah, we should play that clip just for Dan Ryder, who said he was a horrible person because of all the grading he didn't do. It's all right, Dan. It's all right. Okay, Becky, we need some homework. We need an exit ticket. So what is our exit ticket for this episode?
How about you tweet us at Brainwaves with one out of the box or innovative way that you've done one of the seven moves. So remember, they're priming, posing, pausing, probing, bouncing, tagging, or binning, and we'll send a t-shirt to a lucky listener or two.
I can't wait to see what rolls in. And as always, thank you so much for listening, and have a great generic time of day.